Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. In this episode, Purdue professor Frank Lambert examines the origin of the separation of church and state. This is his third and final presentation for the 2012 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. Dr. Lambert gave this presentation on the campus of Mercer University in Macon, Georgia.
Most countries construct myths of their origins, and in doing so, they tend to speak of those myths in divine terms, or at least divine hues. We all know that at the time of American colonization, of English colonization of North America, that the British, or the English, I should say, saw themselves as under the leadership of a divine king or a divine right king. And if you look at the Elizabethan chain of truth, it looked at all of reality in a hierarchy. There was God, there was the King of England, and there was the English people. Americans are no different. We look or tend to look in our popularly constructed memory of the past at the Federal Convention of 1787 that gave birth to the U.S. Constitution in reverential terms. We're helped a bit by Thomas Jefferson, who, upon learning from James Madison — Jefferson was in Paris at the time — learned from James Madison the names of the delegates that would be convening in May of 1787, and Jefferson responded by saying, "My, this looks like an assembly of demigods. These are not mere mortals. These are God men." And frequently we hear of the miracle at Philadelphia in 1787. In fact, there's a book entitled The Miracle of 1787. Most recently, in a debate, if you will, or conversation, Justices Scalia and Breyer, on opposite sides of the ideological fence, agreed that this was something of a miracle that took place in 1787. And finally, we look at what was produced in 1787, the U.S. Constitution, as being part of what historian Pauline Meyer calls America's scripture. And interestingly enough, when Congress decided to construct a new National Archives building in the 1930s, put it in Washington, D.C., they chose as the design a Roman temple. And you walk in that temple, you go into the rotunda, there's a raised platform, looks very much like an altar, and on that altar, the U.S. Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Bill of Rights. America's scriptures. Now, historical fact is always a bit different from the myths that we create about ourselves. And that's true when we look at the Federal Convention of 1787. Without question, these were gifted people, they were far-sighted, they were principled people, but at the same time, they were fully human. Principled, yes, but also protecting private interest and special interest, just like we do today. On the last day of the convention, September 17, Benjamin Franklin, who was quite old at the time, asked his colleague from Pennsylvania, James Wilson, to read a statement. And in that statement, he addressed the people that had assembled there. There were some dissenters at the end. In fact, three prominent delegates refused to sign the draft: Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, and most embarrassingly, Edmund Randolph, who had introduced the Virginia Plan that served as the blueprint for the Constitution, and another Virginian, George Mason, refused to sign the draft. And Mason had said, "Look, we conceive this thing in secrecy. And indeed, the Constitutional Convention was held in absolute secrecy. Can't imagine something like that happening today. And we are now sending it to the people through state conventions, ratifying conventions with the message, take it or leave it. There's no room for amendments. Here's the draft, vote it up or down. So Mason refused to sign it, and in fact he said, what I think we ought to do, send it out to the people in these state conventions, let them look at it, consider it, make recommendations for changes, and let's have another convention, including what the people have to say, and I think we'll have a better product. In his speech, Benjamin Franklin rejected that idea. And he rejected the idea because he rejected the notion that this assembly was an assembly of demigods. He said it's an assembly of fallible men. And if you have a second convention, he said, no doubt you will attract men of wisdom, but you will also attract, as we have in this convention, quote, men with all their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interest, and their selfish views. So according to Franklin, these were altogether human beings with all of the strengths and weaknesses that we have. Miracle? Not according to many people, many of the delegates who, after September 17, wrote home and talked about what had happened. Many of them talked about the importance of conciliation, give and take, bargaining, compromise. And in fact, the quote that I like best is the one from Nicholas Gilman, a New Hampshire delegate, who wrote his brother and said, this was hammered out by, quote, bargain and compromise. Sacred Scripture, Thomas Jefferson, upon returning, and indeed several years later, looked at how Americans were beginning to view the Constitution, and it disturbed him. He said that people are looking at the Constitution with too much reverence and too little understanding. He would like to see people actually read the Constitution and think about it, rather than seeing it as an icon. So what I would like to do today is to try to go inside the Constitutional Convention and look very specifically at how these principled but yet interested men regarded religion and the place of religion in the New Republic. In other words, how did they constitute religion in the New Republic? No delegate had studied constitutional history and theory more than James Madison, perhaps the smallest in stature of all of the delegates, barely 5 feet tall, maybe 5'2". Some say he weighed less than 100 pounds, but the guy was exceedingly industrious in learning. He was a smart guy. In fact, before the Constitution, a year and a half before the Constitution, he wrote Jefferson in Paris and said, I want everything that's ever been printed on confederations. And Jefferson sent boxes of books back to Madison, and he devoured them. Because Madison, unlike other people at the time who were dissatisfied with government under the Articles of Confederation, thought that more needed to be done than simply adding power to the existing Congress. Almost everybody agreed that the Congress under the Articles of Confederation needed to have an independent taxing authority. It needed to have some sort of military presence. It needed to have some sort of executive. But Madison, while agreeing that it needed more power, thought that it needed a totally different structure. And we're indebted to Madison, by and large, for the Federalist structure that emerged. He saw the problem as this. How do we give much more power to the central government without abusing the rights of the people? How do you balance power and liberty? And so he came up, or he embraced, the principle of separation. That's the way to do it, separating power. Make sure that no particular interest group can grab enough power to influence the whole. And so separation is at the heart of the Constitution, the principle of separation. We look at the separation of powers, dividing power into three branches of government, legislative, executive, judicial, with checks and balances and what have you. It's far from perfect. Sometimes there are boundary disputes, but the principle of separation. Secondly, let's divide, separate power from the central government in the states. That's federalism. So that we've got local power, we've got central power. And Madison thought that there should be separation of church and state. Many people today, when they talk about separation of church and state, they go back to Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist and the wall of separation. Madison, perhaps, was even more consistent and insistent than Jefferson on the separation of church and state. And part of that came from his very early experience. In fact, the first case that he had as a lawyer. He had been at Princeton, came back to Virginia, and some of his neighbors, Baptist neighbors, a minister, who was arrested for violating Virginia's laws on itinerancy. This guy did not bother to get a permit from Virginia to itinerate. And so Madison, who was a nominal Anglican, member of the Church of England, defended the Baptist. And he won. So he started his career, his public career, on issues of religious liberty and how do we keep the government out of religion. And then yesterday we talked about the fight in Virginia for religious liberty. And Madison was at the forefront of that. He later said this never would have happened without the Baptist and the Presbyterians and all of those dissenters who were who lived in the backcountry of Virginia. Tidewater was Anglican. The majority in the assembly, Anglican. But the people, the majority of the people, Jefferson said as many as two-thirds were dissenters. And as a result, Virginia passed the most extensive, unfettered act of religious liberty. And it's that act that becomes the model for the delegates at Philadelphia in 1787. Now, they had other choices. They could have followed the model of Massachusetts, for example. Massachusetts continued with an establishment. In fact, two states of the 13 continued after 1776 with an establishment, Connecticut and Massachusetts. And the delegates in the Massachusetts Constitutional Convention saw themselves as quite liberal, quite enlightened. They had an establishment, but yet they tolerated dissenters, Baptist and what have you. Toleration was not what Madison was interested in. Religious toleration is a power granted by a state. They will allow dissenters to do certain things. And Madison's position, the Baptist position, was the state does not have the right. They don't have that power. They don't have the right to say anything about what people can, how people can worship. Well, before we go inside the hall there, the state hall in Philadelphia, and see what went on, let's look at the religious landscape that Madison and the other delegates encountered in 1787. Number one, the fastest growing churches were all voluntary churches. They were the dissenters. They were the Baptists. They were the Methodists. They were the Presbyterians. And the so-called state churches, the congregational churches in New England and the Church of England, and the Church of England, obviously, after 1776, was no more. It became the Episcopal Church. Those were relatively stagnant. So the reality is, if you're going to form a constitution in the name of the people, you better pay attention to where the people are casting their lots concerning religion, and it's with these fast-growing evangelical voluntary groups. Secondly, while 10 of the of the 13 colonies had some form of establishment, they never had European-style establishments with all of the machinery behind it. For example, in Virginia, with the Anglican Church as the established church, there was never a resident bishop. Well, if you have a hierarchical church, an episcopal form of church government, and you don't have any bishops, that's kind of tough. And not only that, in Virginia, the governing body was made up of laymen, the vestry. They're the ones who really had the power. In fact, they could hire and fire the rectors of the various parishes. So while there was an experience with establishment, not with powerful establishments. Third, in the religious landscape, there was growing diversity. This is the time, this is the moment when we begin to see groups like the Unitarians, the Universalists, beginning to pop up. And later on, certainly in the 19th century, we would see new churches, new religions mushrooming all over America. And fourth, while virtually all people affiliated with Christian churches were Protestants, there were very few Catholics, and incidentally, one of the ugly parts of the American landscape in 1787 was the virulent anti-Catholicism. Not a pretty part of our past. But even among Protestants, religious differences mattered. We talked about the Great Awakening yesterday. At one point, George Whitefield, who was a leader in the Awakening, accused the professors at Harvard of not knowing as much about Christianity as Muhammad. That's a rather nasty thing to say. So religious differences mattered in 1787. Knowing that, the delegates arrived, and remember, they're trying to create a more perfect union. And the last thing they wanted to do was to have a fight over religion. So as we'll see in a moment, in essence, they ignored religion as much as they possibly could. But we'll come back to that in a moment. Let's look at how delegates viewed religion in the New Republic. Number one, nearly everybody in that hall was a professing Christian. Sometimes people from the right see them all as Bible-thumping evangelicals. People from the left see them all as deists. Not the case in either way. They were all professing Christians, the lone exception perhaps being Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was religious. I mean, he wrote his own creed, and he said, "I believe in one God. I believe in an afterlife. I believe in God as creator. I believe in providence." About Jesus Christ, don't know. Haven't thought about it a lot. Anyway, I'm going to die pretty soon, and I guess I'll know firsthand. The delegates did believe in God as creator. Much of their work, especially in endorsing earlier the Declaration of Independence, they talk about nature's God. Now, that's a deist construct, but nevertheless, it's God the creator. Nature's God granted people, gave people natural rights. So whatever they conceived that they were doing as delegates, as people, it was over the overarching superintendence of nature's God. They believed in God's providence. Now, they certainly did not believe that God had people on strings and manipulated people to do certain things. And they believed that oftentimes providence was best seen after the fact. We won, God must have been with us along the way. They believed that God's law is a higher law than anything that they could come up with. perhaps most importantly for their deliberations in 1787, they believed that Christian teachings were the fountain of morality, and morality is the foundation of republican virtue. So they saw absolute necessity of Christian teachers laying the groundwork of a moral society, a moral population. Because if you don't have that, in a republic, which is not based on coercion, it's not based on the king sending in the troops to keep people in line, it's based on the rule of law, it's based on people doing the right thing, then moral teachings were extremely important. And incidentally, so much has been written about Jefferson and his religion. Jefferson certainly was not anybody's orthodox Christian by a long shot. He was a free thinker. In fact, at one time he said that he was a church of one. But Jefferson had the greatest admiration for the moral teachings of Jesus. In fact, he said that that moral code was the sublimest code ever developed. And if you know anything about the Jefferson Bible, and you can get a replica of it at Amazon, it's a very, very thin version. And can you imagine this? I just picture Jefferson sitting in the White House, and he was the first president that went into to the White House, sitting there at night, and he's creating this Bible. And of course, he created the Bible not by adding anything, but subtracting from what was there. And he pretty much started out by ripping out the entire Old Testament. He didn't like the God that was depicted in the Old Testament, tyrannical and what have you. He just ripped all that out. He didn't like Paul, so he rips Paul out. Well, you're left with a pretty thin set of the Gospels, and he pulled out everything that smacked of miracle. So you end up with the reputed teachings of Jesus. So it's a very thin volume. But I have to say, if you're going to start somewhere, I'm not so sure that isn't a pretty good place to start. And then finally, the delegates viewed religion in the new, in viewing religion in the new republic, believed in freedom of conscience and religious liberty, not religious toleration, religious liberty. And I would suggest to you that what they do with that conviction of religious liberty will end up in the most radical part of the U.S. Constitution, and that is the separation of church and state. I mean, if you look at the Constitution within the context of 1787, it is a liberal and enlightened document. I mean, what it does is takes principles of enlightenment and actually incorporate them in a constitution. I mean, enlightenment thoughts had been bandied about for 100 years, but nobody had said, we're going to constitute our society around these ideas. And the Americans did that. But protected slavery, protected the slave trade. The people who ran the country before 1776 ran the country after 1787. Not all that radical. What was radical was separation of church and state. Now, having looked at what the delegates believed about religion, let's look at their points of disagreement. And there was a lot of disagreement among religious people throughout American society, and it's no surprise that there would be differences within the delegates. I've already mentioned that Franklin rejected the divinity of Jesus. There was a growing number of people who embraced the Unitarian view. John Adams, who was in London at the time, but very influential, he had written a treatise on what the Constitution should look like. Adams was a Unitarian. He said the math didn't add up on 3 and 1 and 1 and 3. He said he couldn't get his head around that. And Jefferson, of course. Number two, few of the delegates ever spoke publicly of Jesus or Christ. If you look at their comments, a lot of talk about God, a lot of talk about Creator, a lot of talk about Providence, very few public comments about Jesus or Christ. Number three, some were quite lax in their attendance at public worship, including the father of our country. George Washington kept a diary, and in one year, some enterprising, probably mischievous historian went through that diary and looked at every entry for Sundays and concluded that he went fox hunting more than he went to church. Fourth, many of the delegates were free thinkers. They came out of this atmosphere of the Enlightenment, where people were encouraged to think for themselves, and they were free thinkers regarding biblical interpretation. No inerrancy believers there. And in fact, they were unwilling to accept what somebody else had to say about the Bible just out of hand. They certainly did not subscribe to the authority of somebody because that person happened to be a minister or an author or what have you. Fourth, they believed that the church did not need the protection of the state. James Madison had written most eloquently about that in his Remonstrance. And he said, if you look at the history of the Christian church, indeed it flourished at times of persecution. It doesn't need the power of the church. Isaac Bacchus, the Baptist, who was an advocate of separation of church and state, religious liberty, talked about when Constantine endorsed or embraced or protected Christianity in the Roman Empire. He said, on the one hand, people say, isn't that great? Here he is, we've gone from the Romans persecuting Christians to protecting Christians. He said, you better watch what you bargain for there, because that cuts both ways. The guy that has the power to protect you also has the power to demand that you do things in a certain way. Look, stop your internal squabbling, go hold yourself a council, and come up with a creed that everybody can agree upon. Fifth or sixth, I've lost count. You know, if you're taking notes, you know what number it is. They feared sectarianism. They feared sectarianism. Religious disputes threatened unity. I mean, all of these people had just come out of constitutional conventions at the state level. They had fought religious wars in those. They knew that this was a divisive issue. And they knew that people, sectarians, believe passionately in their particular perspective, and many of them are unwilling to compromise. You know, my own observation is that people, and I think this is true in people's convictions about religion and politics, and also patriotism, you know, people's views of their nation, everybody sees themselves as belonging to the best or number one. You know, you never hear people from any country stand up saying, you know, we're number four, we're number 83, or our religion is second, third, I'd say fourth, fifth rate, something like that. People have very strong convictions about these, and the delegates feared sectarianism. And finally, they were far more interested in moral behavior than theological debate. As a matter of fact, John Adams, when John Adams went to Harvard, his dad wanted him to be a minister. And he was so opposed to all of the Calvinist debates and theological, he thought, hair-splitting, that he was absolutely disgusted with it, so he became a lawyer. But overall, they really feared the intermingling of church and state. The delegates, for the most part, were well-read, and they knew history. And they knew what happened when church and state were conjoined. And they thought that damage was done to both. Damage done to the church, damage done to the state. So they saw throughout history the unholy bargain of priest and king, of church and state. And they did not want anything to do with that. So what did they do at the convention about religion? Wow. First of all, they largely ignored what was happening. And again, you can do a keyword search of everything that was said that we have records of. of the federal convention and the state ratifying convention. And religion is barely mentioned. Christ was mentioned none in the 4 months at Philadelphia. Four times in all of the state ratifying conventions. Jesus mentioned none in Philadelphia, two times in the state ratifying convention. The Bible, two times in Philadelphia, six times out in the states. God, 12 times in Philadelphia, 36 times out in the states. Several times were popular phrases like, "Good God, sir," or "God knows how many more times." You know, not exactly the kind of reverent expression that we ought to have. Religion came up just twice as an issue at the convention. The first time it came up was in the midst of a heated debate in June over the election of Congress. Would it be by states? Would it be by population? Tempers were getting a bit short. And so that was when Franklin suggested that perhaps we ought to turn to a chaplain, and perhaps we ought to turn to prayer. And he reminded his fellow delegates that we won independence because of the providence of God. God led us through that war. God can lead us through our difficulties here. So he made the motion that we hire a chaplain, that we have daily prayer, and it failed. Out of respect to him, and Madison talks about this later on, out of respect to him, Madison said the motion was sent to a committee. And you know what happens there. It was tabled. In his own notes, Franklin says only four people expressed any interest in prayer. Well, Alexander Hamilton probably expressed best why people rejected prayer, and it wasn't because they were opposed to prayer. It wasn't an anti-religious act at all. He feared that, look, the people sent us here. We're the people's delegates. And if when we got to the first difficult point, we punted, or we said, okay, we give up, we'll just turn it over to God, people are not going to have very much confidence in us. So let's stay here, work it out. Now, interestingly enough, a myth came up around this Franklin motion. A guy by the name of William Steele, later on in the 19th century, wrote a letter to his son. It was later made public. And Steele said that he had had a conversation with one of the delegates who were there, and the delegate said Franklin made his proposal, it passed, they had prayer, and immediately they worked out their differences. It was miraculous. Upon reading that, Madison said, baloney. Didn't happen. Absolutely didn't happen. I have to say that that found its way into Timothy LaHaye's and David Barton's accounts of the early beginning, and Pat Robertson loves to talk about that. Facts don't matter. The second issue, religious issue, had to do with the question of religious test for office holders. Would there be a link between one's religion and one's right to hold office? Now, many of the state constitutions, and as a matter of fact, that's true throughout much of the 19th century, many of the states did have religious tests for office holders. Members of the legislature, the governor, had to swear various things. And in South Carolina, it was the most extensive. I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe in the Old and the New Testament. I believe that the Lord's coming again. I mean, it was a confession. So only people who could subscribe to that would be eligible for office holding. Franklin said all of those just promote hypocrisy. Have you ever seen a politician that could not easily say, believe that? Sure, no problem. But at Philadelphia, it was decided that there would never be, I mean, it actually has that language, that Congress shall never pass a law requiring a religious test for office holders. So Church of State was to operate in separate spheres. The phrase does not appear, separation of church and state does not appear in the Constitution, but in fact the delegates separated church and civil authority. And they left religion to the states and to individuals. Interestingly enough, 1776, same year of the Declaration, Adam Smith published his Wealth of Nations. And in there, he talks about religion in market terms. And he compares state religions with free religion, well, evangelicals, voluntary religion. And he said, if you look at it as a market, the free churches run circles around the state churches. There's no incentive for the rector of a state church to go out and seek new members. In fact, the attitude there is, we have our church here. If you want to come, come, fine. And so he said, you have real industry in those free churches, in those evangelical churches, and they're the ones that are going to grow. So he did not use the phrase free market of religion. I use it, but that's what he was describing, a free market of religion. If government stays out of it and lets voluntary groups of believers go out and practice and believe what they will, then in the end, the truth will out. When the draft Constitution arrived in the various states to be ratified or to be considered for ratification, there were three points of debate concerning religion, and I want to address those in the 8 minutes that we have left. One, there was great concern, and I mentioned this yesterday, over the fact that there was no acknowledgement of God at all. There was no mention in the preamble of God's providence, of God's mercy, or what have you. And that particularly bothered people in the New England states. People who were accustomed, for example, in Connecticut, to reading the fundamental orders of Connecticut, a constitution, if you will. Some say it was the first constitution in America, 1638. And if you look at the preamble of it, it's very explicit that this government exists to promote the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it's all in the name of God. So they did not see that in the U.S. Constitution, and some people were concerned about it. Those that countered that said, look, you know, why should it be there? I mean, the people can make that acknowledgement. That's where religion is. It's in the hands of the people. They're free to make that acknowledgement, and I'm sure they do. Secondly, there was the fear of non-Christian office holders. If you don't have a religious test, you might end up having infidels, and this is coming out of the North Carolina State Ratifying Convention. You might have infidels, you might have Muslims, you might have Hindus, and what have you. And a Reverend Caldwell was one of the delegates, a Presbyterian, and he was just frenetic about this. You know, we're going to end up having a Muslim as president or something else. And James Iredell, another delegate, said, you know, how many Muslims do we have in this country? You know, let's be real. The people are going to decide who is going to be president. And while you can have a constitutional ban on religious tests, people themselves are going to have a religious test. And we see this in our politics today. You know, voters can exercise or impose a religious test, and they do that. Third, and most disturbing to most people in the ratifying convention, there was no explicit guarantee of religious freedom. Patrick Henry and others went on and on about the lack of a Bill of Rights. Now, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and others had thought about a Bill of Rights and explicitly rejected the idea of a Bill of Rights. And they did it not because they were opposed to protecting rights, but they thought that the Bill of Rights would constrict the people's rights. They said, look, this Constitution grants specific powers to the federal government. If the power is not granted, the government doesn't have it. And so they said, you know, we don't need to say people have these 10 rights, but no more. And that was the implication. Well, Madison, whatever else he was a practical politician, and he knew that this would never pass unless he sent a signal to the delegates that if you will go ahead and ratify the Constitution, I will personally make sure that we have a Bill of Rights, including a protection of religious freedom. The Constitution passed by the narrowest margins. Two votes change. In Virginia, there is no, in New York, there is no Constitution. We talked today about, how divided we are. We've always been divided. We were divided from the beginning, so don't worry about divided. And in fact, I get worried when we aren't divided. I think dissent is is a guarantee of freedom. And dissent means that those out of power are going to challenge those in power. I don't sometimes like the spirit or the substance of that challenge, but nevertheless, dissent is directly related to freedom. Madison himself was in the first Congress. Many people said, look, this thing is ratified, we got the government going, we really don't need the Bill of Rights. He said, no. If this government is going to have the confidence of the people, we have to be good to our words. I said we would have a Bill of Rights, and he drafted the Bill of Rights. And 10 of the provisions ended up being, with some modifications, the Bill of Rights that we enjoy today. Let me close by looking at a couple comments on what happened in 1787 from prominent people after the fact. Writing in the early 1800s, Benjamin Rush, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, a good friend of Jefferson and others, applauded the Republican spirit of 1776. And he thought that Americans had embraced the public good and had put it ahead of private gain. But now, in the early 19th century, he lamented that America was awash in selfishness and seemed to be, quote, bebanked, bewhisked, and a bebought, bedollared place. I love that. Bebanked, bewhisked, and a bedollared place. And what he called on Americans to do is to seek their moral foundations. It's all right to have a structure of government. It's all right to have a new constitution. But if it's going to work, if we're going to serve the public good, if we're going to be true to founding ideals and principles, then we must return to moral values. And then finally, near the end of Madison's life, and of the really iconic fathers, he was the last one to die in the 1830s, near the end of his life, he reflected on how the nation had fared under the separation of church and state, how it had fared in a free marketplace of religion. He concluded, and he put this in writing, by separating church and state, by making support of religion voluntary, churches were numerous. They were springing up everywhere. There was a revival, the Second Great Awakening. All religious views were expressed with an energy unheard of where there was an established church that enjoyed state support. So in Madison's view, separation of church and state worked for the benefit of the spread of the gospel. Thank you.
That was the final presentation from Purdue professor Frank Lambert for the 2012 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. His other two lectures in this series are also available as podcasts. For more information on the Sheridan Lectures, visit our website at bjconline.org/lectures.